Good afternoon. I'm Jean, and I'm a rather nervous co-alcoholic.
Hi, Jean.
Thank you. When I first received the job of choosing a speaker for this program, I asked my very dear, long-time, notice I didn't say old, Al-Anon friend, dear Pat Hallowell, whom should I contact? And she said, flat out, get Gracie Arnofsky. She is simply marvelous. I heard her tape. We all agreed this is the gal for us. But I thought I'd better just be sure, you know. So I called again, not my old, but my longtime dear friend in IDAA, Al-Anon, Ruth Bristow. And she said, oh, definitely, Gracie, but I'll check with Mildred. So, and Jerry's wife. So the consensus of opinion was, yes, you want to hear Gracie. So in fear and trembling, I kept putting it off and putting it off. What if she says no? What will I do? And finally, I got my courage together. I phoned her. And this lovely, charming, warm voice came over the phone and said, honey, I'd love to. So without further words from me, I would like to give you all the pleasure of hearing my dear new friend in Al-Anon, Gracie Arnofsky. God bless you.
Thank you, Jean. I am Gracie Arnofsky. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Please, for all of you who are just being served or in the middle of your lunch, continue. For those of you who have heard me and would like to leave, be my guest. The doors are that way. For those of you who haven't and don't want to, the doors are still that way. And that's okay. I don't know what keeps going off up here, and as long as it's okay with you, it's okay with me. I think we've got some hot wires back here, and it isn't me. By God's grace and an alcoholic spouse, I am a member of the Preston Al-Anon family group in Dallas, Texas, and I am so grateful to be a member of Al-Anon, and I think I'm glad to be with you all today. I'm not real sure at this point. After an introduction like that, it makes you wonder. I would be completely remiss if I didn't say thank you to Jean and Hardy for making me feel so extremely welcome and so very much at home from my arrival time on Thursday. I never cease to be amazed, and I never cease to wonder at how fortunate each and every one of us are in this fellowship, that no matter where we go, we are with the people that care and that love us in spite of us. And I never cease to wonder how come we in this room, and rooms just like it everywhere, are the lucky ones. Thank you for letting me share with you today. I mentioned there are a number of people in here who've heard my story. It hasn't changed a great deal because I'm still living with the same drunk. And I imagine that as long as I do, it'll kind of basically be the same. Perhaps there's a bit of growth, and I hope those of you who haven't heard me for a while will see this, because I think all of us strive for growth in this fellowship. Jean doesn't know how very close I came to saying thank you, but I'd rather not, because I still suffer from being intimidated, and knowing about IDAA, having attended only one conference previously several years ago, I sure as heck didn't want to get up in front of a group of people that were going to analyze, tear me apart, and do all of these things and say, aha, the manifestations of her emotions caused all this, the manifestations of her frustrations caused all this, and all those good things that we think about. And then I thought, how ridiculous. I can only be intimidated if I allow myself to be so. And we're all here for the same reason. because alcoholism is a family illness. That is the reason. So I can't be much different than anybody else out there. And then I was okay. I have nothing to talk about except what our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us to talk about. Our Al-Anon literature tells us the same thing, and that's basically what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now, or at least trying to be what we would like to be right now. I was born and raised in Denver, Colorado. I grew up in a home that any child, I think, would be so very blessed with. A loving home, caring mother, caring father, extremely loving but not possessive with their love, allowing my older and younger brother and me the right to do what we needed to do to become adults. We were granted a great deal of freedom with a great deal of firmness. And everything in our home revolved around family and friends. Our home was always an open one for friends. And I can reflect back today, going back many years, and I'll tell you how old I am in a minute, fact that I was probably looking for an alcoholic many, many, many years ago. Because it was my role in life and my goal, if you will, or lot in life, however you want to describe it, to take care of people. People always came to me with their problems. This is going back to when I was a little kid. By the time I got to university, or even in high school, the kids that were experimenting with alcohol, we didn't have drugs back then, or if we did, I wasn't aware of them. The sickies and the ones who got sick from drinking, they either dumped them on our doorstep at home or they came to my room in the dorm at school and said, "Hey, Gracie, we've got one in the loo. Let's do something about it. Come help her." And I was always helping. I was Miss Fix-It. I was always going to fix everything. So, yeah, I was looking for it. And then I picked up our book, Living with an Alcoholic, and I found a beautiful line in there that says, "We who love an alcoholic, we take on the role of parents of wayward children." You doctors, you drunks out there didn't know that, did you? You're our kids. And this is the way we are. And I think all of us basically follow this role, if you will. I had a lot of fun growing up. There was no drinking in our home, but there was alcohol in our home. Mother and Dad didn't indulge. We were not denied this. Dad strongly suggested that if and when the time came that we found it necessary to have a drink, he'd fix us one. And he did. He fixed me my first one, and it was abominable. I can understand the reason today, because I'm sure it was probably 95% booze and 5% mix, and he didn't want it to taste good. And I didn't like it, and I put it down. I went on to university, and there was a lot of drinking going on, but it wasn't apparent that anyone was suffering from alcoholism to me, or a drinking problem. I didn't even know what that was. I didn't need it. I didn't need alcohol to have a good time and to be a part of the crowd. And this is important for me to remember today, and you'll hear that in a bit. While I was a freshman in university, I was invited to spend the Christmas holidays in Dallas with a classmate. And on the train going down, she said, "When we arrive, Gracie, you are going to be dating my brother's best friend. And he's been like a big brother to me, and he's just real, real, real sweet guy and lots of fun. Go out with him and have a good time and just don't believe anything he says." Well, I was 17 and I was a freshman in college and have all the answers to everything, and you're sophisticated, you think. And you think, well, if he's going to play that kind of a game, so are you. And these were my plans. I thought, well, he can dish it out and I can give it right back. And We arrived in Dallas and we got off of the train and there he stood. Now, growing up, I was very athletic. I participated in many athletic situations, events, whatever, from tennis to swimming to showing horses and so on down the line. And by the time I reached junior high school and discovered boys and discovered that I liked them and still do, I had a vision of whom I would marry, and he was going to be 6'4", and he was going to be an All-American football player. And we were going to go through life doing all these fun things. Well, he was at the station, and there he was, and he was 5'6". And the closest he'd ever been to a football was playing in the band. But, you know, he was different. And how many of us who love the alcoholic make this statement? They're different. He was fun. He was exciting. He was 3 years older than I, and he still is. He was a big man on campus because he told me he was. He was extremely sophisticated, I thought. And I thought this was really neat. We dated for 2 weeks. Now, our dating consisted of going to a drive-in tavern. Dallas back then was dry. You could not buy liquor except by the bottle. We had a package law. We used to brown bag it. But you could drive into a hamburger place, and still can in some, and you could order beer in the car or ale. And he introduced me to Red Top Ale, and I thought it was vile. But I pretended that I liked it. Because, you see, I wanted him to be impressed with me. This is something I have found out about me. I wanted you to be impressed with me. I wanted to impress everyone with whom I came in contact with. I was not to know this until I found this program. I was what is commonly known as a people pleaser. And I would do anything to get your approval. So I sat there pretending that I enjoyed this raunchy stuff. And we had a good time. I know we were feeding each other's ego at the time, but I was not to learn this for a long time. After 2 weeks in Dallas, I returned to university and I wrote him a letter and did not receive a response and sort of just forgot about him and went on about my merry way. And it wasn't too many months later that I was invited back to Dallas for a 2 week stay. And you know who was waiting for me. And you know who I was with for the next 2 weeks. And again, it was fun and games. We were going through a period at that time that many of you in this room are old enough to remember. It was 1941 when David and I met, and it was December. By the next trip down to Dallas, things in our country, or our country in itself, was in a complete state of turmoil. Many of the young men on campus were getting ready or were already gone to active service. And boys were disappearing. And I started having thoughts, real frightening thoughts for me, that what was I going to do? I wasn't going to have anybody to go out with, and I wasn't going to have anyone to go through life with. And these were uppermost in my mind on that 2 week stay in Dallas. But I wasn't sophisticated enough, if you will. I wasn't manipulative enough at that time. That had to come a few months later to do anything about it. So I returned to university at the end of that period. And then some months later, I went back to Dallas by invitation for a 2 week stay. And of course, you know who was waiting. And during that 2 week period, we decided that we would be married. And this is an honest program. And you told me I must be honest when I came in here, and I find it difficult many times. I don't think we had anything to do with it. I think I did. By now, David had graduated from Southern Methodist and was in professional school. He had no plans for a wife, certainly not in the immediate future. And certainly his plans did not include me in any way. But I convinced him that he could not possibly get along without me. I'm not real sure how I did it. I'd hate to have to try to do it today. But talk about the game of manipulation and control. And this we play, every one of us, the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. We manipulate each other. Yes, I manipulated him into this, with no intention of marrying until he finished school. And I returned to university, and he returned to school, and everything was just lovely, and this was January. In April, a ring arrived in the mail, and in June, we walked down the aisle. So the courtship, over a two-year period of time, lasted 6 weeks at a time. And then the marriage took place. We couldn't live without one another. We were 895 miles away from one another, and he didn't write letters, and he still doesn't. We have friends in California who say he's the only drunk that ever got sober that still has black cord fever. The telephones went bananas, and he was calling constantly, and if he wasn't calling me, I was calling him. And, you know, back then, LD was pretty expensive. And I think both of our families were extremely relieved that we were finally going to be in the same city. We were married on June the 10th, 1943, at 8 o'clock in the evening, and we had 3 days for a very brief honeymoon because he was on the accelerated program due to wartime. We left the wedding reception, got in the automobile, and started to the mountains in Colorado, but we made one stop. And many of you can guess what that stop was. We stop at a package store to pick up a bottle, to pick up the courage that we both needed to consummate a marriage. A marriage of a very sophisticated young man and a very bright-eyed, wise young lady. Both of us were absolutely scared to death. And we didn't know what to do, except to drink. And I crawled in that bottle with David, and I stayed in that bottle with him for the next 24 years. I was to drink with him. I was to drink without him. I was to drink with other people, and I was to drink alone. And I know today that it is only by the grace of God that I am not an alcoholic. You see, I tried, and I flunked the test. I have probably put enough booze away to float this hotel. I am firmly convinced today, and this is strictly my own opinion, there is just no way you can make one out of one that isn't one. It's that simple. You see, I never had to have a drink in my life. I had a compulsion and an obsession with that man that I was living with. A compulsion to do something about him. An obsession to change him. Never one time knowing that it was alcohol. Never one time. We had a lot of fun in our early marriage. If we didn't, I don't believe I'd be here today. We had many more good times than we did bad. We didn't have a lot of money. When you're in dental school and you're both working, trying to get there, you don't have a lot of money to throw around. You also don't have a lot of time to party and to play. But every time we had the money to buy a bottle, we did. Every fraternity party we ever attended, we always took a fifth or a quart. a lot of the students took a pint. Not us. Not us. Ours always had to be the biggest and the best. I know today that going back 35 years ago, that drinking was a problem to me then, just as it could become a problem to me once again today. I know today that I am as powerless over alcohol, and that if I allow it to, my life will become totally unmanageable once again. You see, the problems back then, every time we partied and every time we drank, he got drunk, so did I. He never pointed an accusing finger at me, but I did at him. If he passed out, I berated him the next morning. If he was still mobile, I berated him at that time. He was the one who held my head while I got sick. He was the one who put me to bed to pass out. He was the one who took care of me the next morning. Talk about tender, loving care. He gave it to me, and he got nothing from me. I'm not proud of this. That's just the way it was. We went on having fun and having fusses. I think the old song, a feudin', a fightin', and a fussin', and that's kind of where we were. And then we'd make up. And then we'd feud, and then we'd fight, and then we'd fuss, and then we'd make up. And everything would be great, and then we'd go around again. And then he finished school, and he was called to active duty with the Navy, and I was able to go with him. And now we really were living in tall cotton. Because, you see, he was a gentleman and an officer, or an officer and a gentleman, call it what you will. And we had more money than we'd ever had, and we really got with it. We started the partying and the playing and the drinking and doing all the things we wanted to do when we wanted to do them. And we had a perfectly marvelous time at the expense of Uncle Sam, at the expense of ourselves also. Because, of course, the drinking was more frequent, the fussing was more frequent, but then the making up was too, and that was always fun. That was always great. We were gone 19 months, and we returned to Dallas, and Dave opened an office, and I went to work for him. And now everything was really fantastic. We had a practice that anyone could ever possibly hope or dream for. We built our first home. We could party every night. And I will tell you that the alcoholism was in our lives back then by one simple statement that I think many of you in this room particularly will understand. Most normal people, professional people, keep office hours from 9 to 5 or 8:30 to 4:30. Our office hours were from 12 noon until 9 at night. That ought to tell you something. Because, you see, you have to rest sometime. We partied every night, many times at the after-hours clubs, because we weren't ready to go home, you see. So we'd hit all the late spots. We wouldn't get home many, many, many mornings until the sun was coming up, and we had to sleep. So we made the office hours at our convenience, and amazingly enough, we had patients who loved these hours. Naturally, they did. They were doing the same thing we were doing. They couldn't keep those early appointments either. In 1948, our first little boy was born. I was terribly thrilled and I was terribly excited because I finally had a baby, and I want you to recognize that I. because this is a syndrome I suffered from for many, many years. I call it the I syndrome. I wanted a child. I should have a child. And yet doctors had told me this was not possible, that I would never have children. And yet a beautiful, very healthy little baby came into this marriage. Now, I was so excited about this child and so grateful to God for him that I hired a housekeeper to come in and take care of him. Because, you see, it was necessary for me now to play not only the role of mother, wife, homemaker, I had to play the role of being accepted in the community. I had to be the civic worker. I had to play the role of the professional man's wife. Whatever in the devil that is, I don't know. I had my own conception of it. I loved that little boy the only way I knew how to love him, and that was a few hours a day. In order to be accepted by you, because you see, I could sit around the clubs or I could sit around a bridge table, brag about my baby and what we had done together for 1 or 2 hours that day. And then at night, I was free to run and play and do the things with my spouse that we wanted to do together. Because you see, by now I was no longer working in the office. He had hired an office gal. And it was necessary for me to do all these other things. In 1949, I couldn't wait to be recognized by one or another of an organization or whatever. I couldn't wait to pick up the newspaper to see if maybe my name was there. And we talk about the selfishness and the self-centeredness and the ego of the alcoholic. Well, we were in Dallas 5 years. And yes, alcoholism had set in great progression in our household. Only neither one of us were aware of it. Other people were. Because back in the early 50s, we were invited to an AA birthday party in Dallas. The alcoholic blocks out, I think we who love an alcoholic block out the things we don't want to remember. I attended that birthday party. And I don't know how they do it up in this part of the country, but in our part of the country, when you have achieved 1 year sobriety or more, there is lots of fun and excitement and birthday cake and all this good stuff. My mind is a complete blank as far as that birthday party is concerned. I don't ever remember hearing the word alcoholic. I don't ever remember hearing the word words Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know. I would have sworn to you, I had never known that you all existed. That was back in the early 50s. People could see in us what we could not see in ourselves. You see, we come into this fellowship thinking that nobody knows. And when we get in here, we find out there isn't anybody who doesn't know. Isn't it amazing? The neighbors know. You know, normies don't do the things we do. They don't keep the shades drawn. They don't pull a passed out drunk out of the car or leave the passed out drunk in the car. They don't scream and holler and yell at one another so that people can hear you for blocks away. They don't get in the automobile and peel out, as the kids call it, with brakes, you know, tires squeaking and driving highways 90 miles an hour to give vent to your anxiety, your frustrations. Normies don't do this. We think nobody knows. What happens to those checks that bounce kind of like a rubber ball? Or maybe you all haven't ever had any of that happen to you. So the banker knows. And the people we've given the checks to, they know. The country clubs know because we don't pay our dues, do we? You know, even the society knows because those checks bounce sometimes, too. They know there's a problem, and we think no one knows. We're going to hide. Where in the devil do you hide a drunk? You know, if you can't tell them any other way, you can tell them by the smell. Or maybe you all didn't smell like one. I lived with one that didn't smell like Aramis, I promise you. Not during the latter stages of the drinking. Yes, during those 5 years, the progression was bad, but I was to learn that it had just begun. When Dave was recalled to active duty, the children and I were going to remain in Dallas and keep the home fires burning. And 2 weeks after he left, he called and said, "How soon can you sell the house and join me in California?" And the kids and I were on our way. You see, I missed my playmate, and I needed him. We need each other. And if we don't need each other, we're going to go out and get somebody that does need us and that we need. Works every time. The house went on the market. The kids and I were on our way. And we arrived in San Clemente, California back a number of years ago when it was still a very small community. We were there just about 3 months, and we had a marvelous time. Now, the housekeeper we had left behind in Dallas, because on Navy pay, there was no way. And that was okay, because for the first time, this gal was to find out what it was like to be a mother. For the first time, I was to find out what it was like to give my babies a bath. Can you believe that? To feed them their meals on schedule. To take them to the beach. Doing the things, pardon me, that normies do every day. And I thought I was normal. And you know something? I loved it. I enjoyed it. This was fun. It was like a little kid playing dress up. It was like a little kid playing with her dolls. And this is kind of the way I looked at those little guys. And they were delightful, and they were enjoyable, and they were fun. Enjoyed it so much that every night we hired a babysitter so that we could drive some 80 miles to Los Angeles to make that to-do. We wanted to do them. It was a drink, to drink, to party, and to Annie. And then we'd on 80 miles on the ways. Both of us bored, and we home safely. Tell me, the good Lord drunk. He do. And I, at the end of a 3 month period, Dave was sent to TD, and the kids stayed in San Clemente without a worry in the world. And he assured us that we know no problems or no contact very shortly. And I don't know what the regulations, I know we have a Navy man with us. I would love to know. An officer wasn't reading over an allotment to sign over an allotment. And Navy personnel was paid twice a month. And he said, "Now don't worry about a thing, because I'll mail my check home to you twice a month." I said, "Okay." Well, pay time came and no mail came. Told you he didn't like to write letters. And some weeks passed and no mail and no money. And I called him. And he could not understand what in the world had happened to it, because he had mailed it yesterday. And I believed him. Well, this went on for a few more weeks, and I called him back, and of course I got the same response, and it had been mailed yesterday, and it did not arrive. So I took action. I went to the base legal officer, and I told him my problems, and mine were over and his began. And he signed over an allotment. You bet he did. Now, I want you to understand something. I could have left California at any given hour of any given day. All I had to do, put those kids in the car and take off. I could have gone to my family. I could have gone to his family. I could have called home. I could have called his family's home and asked for help financially. We have a little thing in us called pride. And there was no way in the world that I was going to let anybody know what was going on in my life. There was no way in the world that I was going to let anyone know that just maybe I'd made a mistake in my marriage. I'd never made a mistake before. And I wasn't going to admit to this one. And there was no way I was going to ask for help. I'd weather it through. I believe that's known as martyrdom. I'd manage on my own, thank you. Well, once the money started rolling in, that was okay. But the anger and the resentment and the hatred and the hurt set in. And when it set in every form that every one of us has experienced. I hated him so much. And I felt so sorry for me. Why me? How could he do this to me? I was simply waiting for his return so I could tell him that I would no longer live with him. Had to wait to face him with this. Of course I did. And the phone rang about 3:30 one morning. And you know who. And he was calling from the ship. And he said, "We dock at Pier so-and-so in San Diego tomorrow. Would you and the boys meet me?" You know where we were. We were down there welcoming the hero home. My playmate was back. And all idea and all thought of separation or divorce went right out in that Pacific Ocean. I had exactly what I needed. We feed on each other's illnesses. My sickie was home. And he had his sickie, and this is what we needed. And we started back on the same merry-go-round. Of course we did. The running and the partying and the drinking and the playing. But it didn't last very long, because the entire division was shipped to the Far East. And it was at this time that we both made the decision that the children and I would be far better off in Denver, close to my family. And we packed up and we took off for Denver. Now, when we did, it was supposed to be for a very brief period. The period turned in to a 3-year span. It was total desertion. And I didn't understand it. I would love to stand here today and tell you that I sat home for 3 years and I cried and felt sorry for myself and became a vegetable, and I didn't. Yes, I sat home for a few weeks and I cried a lot, and I suffered from the plum disease a great deal. Poor little old me. I went back to that same thing. Why me? Why me? How can he do this to me? The same thoughts, the same feelings, the same hurts, the same hates, the same anxieties, all of the things that we experience. And then I got mad. And then I thought, I'll show him. And I went out to show him. Now, I had not the vaguest idea in the world where him was. He didn't know what I was doing and really didn't know, I don't believe, where I was. I was going out to find somebody to rescue me. I didn't have to live this way. Now, I am not proud of those days in Denver, but you see, today I am no longer ashamed of them. Because there's a great line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that tells us that our dark past in God's hands is our greatest treasure. And there may be somebody out there, there may not be, and that's okay, that did some of the things that I did. And you may think you're the only one, and now you know you're not. What did I miss the most? I missed the bright lights, of course I did. I missed the bars, of course I did. I missed all the things that we had done together. I wanted to meet somebody, and I didn't know how. I wanted to meet somebody that was fun and exciting and different. You don't meet those kind in church. So, I headed for the closest bars, which were the officers' clubs. I didn't go to the public ones. That was beneath my dignity, I'll have you know. I had access to Lowry, Fitzsimmons, Buckley. I made good use of them, and I went for one specific purpose, to meet men. And it never ceases to amaze me. Lowry was my very favorite. The reason that it was, as you walked into the bar, there were three or four bar stools right here. And then you had the full length of the bar here. There always seemed to be a vacant bar stool at this short end. And that's what I was looking for. Because you see, it gave me an opportunity to sit down and look you fellas over. It gave me the opportunity to pick and choose. Isn't that great? And you know, you fellas know why we're there. There's some of you gals do too. And it wouldn't be too long before there was a drink in front of me. And it wasn't too much longer until somebody was over sitting beside me and lighting my cigarette. And then it was instant. And yes, I found somebody. Sure I did. And he was extremely eligible, and he was a senior ranking officer, and he was exciting. And he was single. And this was pretty great. Of course, I was still married, you understand. But I was going to do something about that just as soon as I could. And this one was my answer, because he was going to send me to Mexico for an illegal divorce. And I darn near took him up on it. But I went to our family physician, who had known me since childhood. And I told him what my plans were. And he was such a wise man. And he said, honey, before you do anything, you go home and get a piece of paper and a pencil. And you put David on one side and this young man on the other. And you decide what it is about each of them that's so attractive. Well, I followed his suggestion. And you know what I had. There was one over in the Far East somewhere. And I had one in Denver. I didn't know they were alcoholic. I knew they were exactly alike. And I didn't want another one. So I got rid of him. It didn't take me too long to find another, and he was even higher ranking and even more eligible, if possible, and more exciting. And, of course, this time I made the list without going to the family friend. This was number two in Denver, and that one was still lost over in the Far East somewhere. I know today beyond a shadow of a doubt that I love the alcoholic as much as I am capable of loving another human being. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if I were left alone today, I would seek another alcoholic. I promise you one thing, he'd be sober. When you reach age 54, you're a little old to go into training. I'm not sure I could take it. And I don't have to today, and isn't that great? You know, I told you about my parents at the beginning and how they loved us without possessing us and how very wise they were. And all the time that I was living in Denver and doing the things that I was doing, I know that it was probably eating them alive. Never one time did they point a finger at me. One time did they say, you shouldn't. Never one time did they say, you are embarrassing us. They allowed me the right and the dignity to make my own mistakes. And I shall be eternally grateful to them for giving me this. Because you see, I had to do what I had to do. And I had to hurt the way I had to hurt. The degradation, the desolation, the deprivation that every alcoholic feels. I think love and alcoholic have the same feelings. I became frightened after a period of time because I wasn't used to living this kind of a life. I wasn't used to doing the things that I was doing. And I didn't know what to do because, you see, I could not get a divorce. He was out of the country. So I made a decision that I would stay at home and wait until such point in time that he would be found or would show up. And then I would sever this relation permanently and I'd go on about my merry way. And the phone rang one day. And you know who. And I hung up. And he called back and I hung up a second time and he called back a third time. And I listened, and he was in San Francisco, and he wanted me just to fly out and just visit with him. And I told him there was no way. And I don't have any idea how long we talked on the phone. It isn't important. All I know is that I kept saying no way, and the next day I was on my way to San Francisco just to talk about it for a few hours. And then returned to Denver. We started talking. We started visiting. And 4 days later, I returned to Denver to wait for Daddy to start all over. The ever optimist. We always believe that everything's going to be better tomorrow instead of just living for today. And I know today that every time David made me a promise, he meant it. I know this today, and I'm grateful to you people for telling me this and showing me this and making me understand and believe it, because I do believe it. I know that every time he told me he didn't want to drink, he meant it. I know that every time he said, I will not ever do this again, I know he meant it. He was doing the very best that he could do in that situation at that time. Well, Daddy picked us up and we went back to Texas. And we stayed in Dallas a short time. We opened an office and we decided we wanted to get away. And we moved to a small community, and it was very small. We had less than 1,000 people. And we darn near starved to death. So we stayed there less than a year. And we moved further out to the Texas Panhandle, where we were to stay for 8 years. Alcoholism, the family illness, the progressive disease, because it started really progressing. But we weren't to hit bottom yet. We wonder sometimes how far down one has to go. I'm grateful today for what's happening in our program, what the recovering alcoholics are doing today in carrying the message. I'm grateful to our news media today, radio, film, television, so long as we're staying within the confines of our traditions. Because you see, it wasn't like this 11 and a half years ago. It wasn't like this 5 years ago. I believe there is not anything you can pick up or turn on today that there isn't something about alcoholism, the disease, on it. The stigma is still there, yes, in many areas, of course it is, with many people. But this, I believe, we will see dissipate. Thanks to those who are willing to share. Those 8 years in that small community were just the same as they'd been everywhere else. I became involved in everything that I could become involved in. I was president of everything I could become president of, chairman of, on the board of. That community couldn't get along without me. I fought. They've grown and thrived in all the years we've been gone. But you see what I was doing? I was running away. You taught me this. I am a runner. I'll run away every time to escape from reality. Not geographically, locally. I will run into anything that will keep me involved and busy so I don't have to look at me. That prevents me from looking at my old card. I won't have to do that anymore either. Well, everything was fantastic in that small community. It was a dry community. We voted dry and we drank wet. I was talking with someone about it yesterday. I guess it was last night at dinner, and I used to make the whiskey run. We were 89 miles from the closest booze, and I'd take the station wagon and I'd take orders. And I'd bring it back by the case. You know, for everybody at home, all of our running buddies. They have an AA group there now, and I'm so grateful, because, God, they needed one. You know, in a town of 3,400 people, that tells you something, doesn't it? The need for an Alcoholics Anonymous group. Well, I thought everything was rocking along pretty good. Of course I did, because I refused to look at the situation in our household. Dave called me from the office one day and he said, "How do you feel about moving back to Dallas?" And I said, "I think it's a great idea." And 2 weeks later, we were gone. Now, we told people we were going back to Dallas because his mother and father needed us, and they did not. My little father-in-law had retired, and he and my little mother-in-law were doing everything that they had ever planned to do on retirement. The last thing in the world they needed anywhere near them was a drunk son, a mixed-up daughter-in-law, and two screwed-up grandkids, but they got us. Bag and baggage. No, we didn't live with them, blessedly. They just paid the tab for where we lived. They picked us up time after time after time. I went to work immediately. I have to tell you about that job a little bit, because we'd been in Dallas less than a week when I received a phone call, and it was from my husband's best friend, that one way back in the 40s, whose sister had introduced me. And this man said, "I know you're back in Dallas, and I need you. The need to be needed." And I said, "What on God's green earth for?" He said, "Would you come down and talk to me?" He offered me a position. He offered me a career is what he offered me. I knew absolutely nothing about it. Where I was to work was a place that I hated with everything that I could hate with, because it's where the man I lived with had started his drinking career back as a youngster. It is Skid Row in Dallas, and I suppose it'll always be Skid Row. But you see, I am so grateful to this man, because I believe that had he not offered me this job, had I not taken it, I would have been the one in our household that would have ended up. You call it treatment today, we call it the booby hatch. Back then, I would have ended up in our state hospital because I was as close to going over the brink as anybody could possibly go, and I didn't know where to turn for help. It was a very demanding job, and it was a very responsible one, and I had to be there to open that office in the morning and to close it in the afternoon. You see, another way of keeping me off of me. I didn't have to look at me. But the minute I'd leave that office, I'd go home. I'd prepare dinner for those two little guys, and I would withdraw into my room with the doors closed. I completely and totally withdrew from the world after office hours. During office hours, I was just fine, thank you. And during office hours, I listened to everybody's problems that came into my office. I had a private office. It was very luxurious and paneled and all of this comfortable furniture. And people would come in and say, "May I talk to you?" And I said, "But of course." Close the door. And I'd solve their problems. Aren't we great at solving everybody else's problems but our own? Well, the next 3 years were a living hell. I thought they were for me until we found you. And I found out that the man that I was living with was living a hell on earth. Because, you see, he was drinking to live and living to drink, and I didn't know this. I did all the things those last 3 years of drinking that possibly all of us have done in one form or another. Usually I start my talk by saying it has not been necessary for me to plan a murder or a suicide in 11 years and some 3 months, 3.5 months. And it may not mean a darn thing to you, but it darn sure does to me. It means this program works. Because, you see, those next 3 years, I planned ways to murder him. I planned ways to hire somebody to do it for me. I lacked the funds to do it with. I also lacked the knowledge of where you find people like this. I planned his funerals, and then I was scared to death he would die because we had no friends left. Where are you going to get pallbearers? I prayed for all the wrong things. I prayed for him to be killed. Just, dear God, don't let him kill anybody else. When I wasn't planning to do away with him, it was my own demise. And I planned suicide. Oh, did I plan it. It was never going to be in toto, you understand. It was always going to be just a little bit. I don't know quite how you commit suicide halfway. I stole pills from his office. You know, detail men had a marvelous way of dropping them off. I don't think they do that so freely anymore, and I'm glad they don't. I knew a great deal about medication, and I would go over to the office when he wasn't there, which was frequent, and I'd go into his lab, and I would pull the things that I knew were lethal, take them home. And I had my own little private stash. And the night came when I really was suffering from the blahs and the plums and the whole bit, and I thought, this is it. I'll get his attention. And I bathed and put on the prettiest gown I had and did all those good things and got the pills and got the water and put it by my bed and called the doctor. And I was crying to tell him what I was going to do, and he had the audacity to laugh at me. He said, "If you were going to, Gracie, you would have," and then called. "I suggest you go to bed and come into the office tomorrow and we'll talk about it." This is one of the physicians that David is still associated with. People in that clinic knew nothing about alcoholism. The physicians were not aware of alcoholism. They knew something was wrong, but they didn't know what it was. They were willing to go to any length to help me, but they didn't know what the answers were. I promise you they do today. Well, I took water and the pills and dumped them. Wouldn't do it. But several weeks later, I didn't call him. I took the Carbatel and the water and I went to bed. Now, I had very carefully sent the children away for the weekend. And he was not at home. And I took those Carbatel and I came to the next day. I was talking about 24 hours, maybe 22 hours, with the worst hangover I've ever had in my life. And nobody knew anything about it. No one knew a thing. And it wasn't too many months later that I decided that suicide was the answer once again. And I would do it by gas. Because I'd read somewhere that this was an easy way to do it. You just go to sleep. We were living all electrically. And yet, we have such denial when we come into this program. There is nothing wrong with me, thank you. These steps do not apply to me, thank you. I don't know about anyone else. I can speak only for myself. Every one of them apply to me. And particularly two. Well, I was on my way home from work one evening. And something happened, and I was not to know what it was for some months. I knew it was very necessary for me to see the man I was living with, and I did not know where he was. I had to talk to him. And we know, don't we, there are no coincidences in this program. Because he came in home that evening, and he was cold sober. And I told him I wanted to talk to him. Well, you know, we always want to have discussions, don't we, with the drunk. So he wasn't too receptive. What is it this time? We sat down in the den, and I was able to tell him that I no longer cared. I no longer cared what he did, when, where, how, or with whom. That he was no longer a part of my life. That he was free to come and he was free to go. That I had no intentions of leaving until the boys were gone off to university, and then I would get out of his life completely. After finding you people, I know what happened that day. I know that it was a power greater than myself, whom I choose to call God, directing me, because I'd hit bottom and there was no place else for me to go except up. You told me that this is the night that I let go and I let God take care of that alcoholic. This was the night that I let go, period. I detached, not with love, I promise you, but with utter and total relief. Because the weight of the world came off. I was able to go to bed that night and sleep for the first time in I cannot tell you how many months. I slept the night through without getting up 2 o'clock in the morning and jumping out and looking in the out the window to see if he was coming in, and then jumping right back into bed, pulling the covers up to here. Any of you ever do that? You want him home and then you pretend you're knocked out. Wonder why? I no longer went to bed praying that he wouldn't come home or would come home. I no longer stole his money when he did come home, because I did that. Did a lot of things I'm not proud of. I know one thing. I used to take his money, and I never did take all of it. And I promise you one thing. Given another opportunity, I will. He didn't ever know how much he had or didn't have. Well, we rocked along with no communication. If there was anything that needed to be said to either one of us, It was done in writing. I'd leave him a note, he'd leave me a note. And that was it. And my phone rang in the office one day. Guess who? And he said, "I know you don't believe me, but I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous," and I said, "Be my guest," and I hung up. And he came home that night, and he was sober. And there was no communication. And the next day, he called me back in the office with the exact same statement. And he got the same response. "Be my guest," and I hung up. He came home that evening, and he dressed, and he left. By now, young David was a freshman in university down in Austin, and Donnie was finishing his junior year in high school, and when his dad walked out the door, he said, "Mom, do you think Dad really means it, or is it another one of his lies?" And I said, "Son, we'll know when Dad comes home." That was April 21, 1967, and Dad's been coming home ever since. A week later, he invited me to attend an open AA meeting with him, and I went. We were not communicating, but I went out of curiosity. I don't know anything that happened at that meeting, except there were a lot of happy people, and I liked that feeling. And then on Monday night, he invited me to attend my first Al-Anon meeting, and I said, "What is that?" He didn't know. He thought it was for me. And I attended my first Al-Anon meeting, and I hated it. Because, you see, I walked into a room full of the most pious broads I've ever met in my life. They were so good. And I couldn't identify. Instead of identifying with the illness, I tried to people identify, and there was no way. But I kept on going, because my first sponsor will soon have 23 years of sobriety. She's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. 24 years for somebody else to go with him. That got my attention, and I kept on going. You know, I think many of us in this program fail to remember from whence we came. And I plea with each and every one in this room, whether you be alcoholic or Al-Anon, and we may have some Al-Anons in here, that when that new guy or gal comes through the door of your group, tell them the truth about you. Tell them the truth. Don't paint them a picture of everything that's beautiful. Because you see, many times when we come into this program, it gets worse before it gets better. We cannot promise that your marriage will stay together or split. We cannot promise you that your home will be on solid foundation. We can promise you a solution. You no longer have to live in the problem. We can promise you that no situation is so difficult and no unhappiness is too great that it cannot be overcome. The promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the new edition on page 83, we can promise you that. Those are the only promises. Your life will get better. Please tell the new people the truth. Let's not hide it from them. We started communicating, going back and forth to meetings. All we had to talk about was the program. But my word, you know, 11 years and some odd months later, that's what we're still talking about. We've never gotten bored with it. I did not like all of the meetings that he was going to. No. I resented it in many aspects, but he had enough sobriety to sit down and say, "Let's talk about it," and we did, and I became comfortable as I could be in the group that I was attending. I've heard slow learner mentioned several times this weekend. Well, you're looking at the slowest one, because it took me 4 years to find out that I could attend another Al-Anon group from other than the one I was attending. And at the end of 4 years, I found out by getting the cotton out of my ears that I could go any darn place I wanted. And I walked into the Preston group. I walked into a group of people that told me the truth about me and about themselves. They told me I don't graduate from the 12 steps of recovery. They strongly suggested that I start over, and I listened, and I did, and I still am. It's necessary for me to take the first 3 steps every day, lest I forget. I walked into a group of people that gave me a responsibility of an Alateen sponsor, of which I was for 6 years. A responsibility that there is no way in this God's green earth that I could ever repay or return to those young people. Because they gave me love totally and freely with no strings attached. The most beautiful bunch of kids I've ever known in my life for 6 long years. And yet, there is hardly a day that goes by that I hear a sober member of AA or an Al-Anon say, "My kids don't need Alateen." I don't know about your program. Mine tells me that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. That my alcoholic is one drink away from a drunk. That's all. If your kids have never seen you drunk, they may. And how are you going to answer them then? What right do we have to deny them this gift from God that's been given each and every one of us? I don't have that right. Our 2 sons today are 28 and 30. Last December, Christmas night, I was on a plane on my way to Santiago, Chile, to attend the wedding of our oldest son, who married a perfectly delightful Chilean girl. When the wedding ceremony was over, I did not understand a great portion of it because it was all in Spanish, but I knew it was very moving and very effective. And the son turned to me and put his arms around me, and he said, "Mother, thank you for everything." This is a little guy who grew up in one of the sickest homes than a young man could ever grow up in. He has his doctoral degree from Florida State. And 3 weeks ago, he and his bride arrived back in the States and spent a couple of days with us. It's the first time I've ever had to call on anybody from AA for help, and I had to call Hal in Washington and say help, because they couldn't get a place to stay, and he was going up there for job interviews, and God love Hal, he came through. Dave and I have the daughter we've always wanted. She is absolutely one of the loveliest young ladies I've ever known. And I think my son is one of the greatest guys I've ever known. How come I'm the lucky one? Number 2 son graduated cum laude and is not following his chosen educational degree. Kind of like you. He's sales repping. And I would have told you that that kid couldn't sell you a toothbrush. As of February 15th, he had already made his quota for 1978. Be careful what we predict. He is a fantastic guy. Still single, still playing the dating game, bored with it all. Miss Wright hasn't come along, but she will. And when she does, she's going to get one of the greatest guys I've ever known, and this is our son. Back through the years when I used to scream out, "Why me? Why me?" It's with a different connotation today. It's "Why me? How come I'm the lucky one to be given a second chance at living. To be given the chance to learn to love again when there was no love left. How come I have been given a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of recovery therein, and the 12 traditions for our group consciousness? Why me? I don't know the answer. I just thank God every day that I live, that you were here when we got here. And I pray to God you stay here, because I continue to need you, and I will continue to need you every day that I am allowed to live. Thank you for letting me share with you, and for you sharing with me, and I love each and every one of you. Thank you.